We're moving on.
Yeah, we are recording. Yes, and Leo, you're watching that completely behind the scenes.
Okay,
alright. And you'd love coffee tonight as well. So, welcome everybody on this very busy parliamentary day. I'm Roxanne Missingham and I'm the parliamentary librarian. And we have this series, the Vital Issues series, where we try to bring speakers who help us think about issues that are really important to the Parliament. And the topic that we have today is engaging with the social media. We had a very strong turnout earlier this year when we had a great discussion on the project that our current parliamentary fellow Peter Brent is doing, where he's particularly looking at Twitter. And that's a project that will take a whole year. And some of the senators and members in the audience talked about their experiences in using social media, which were very interesting and made us think we should do more to have these sort of conversations. And we're very fortunate today to have James Dello with us. James is a senior business and technical consultant at Headshift. He has a master's in business and technology from the University of New South Wales and is really very interested in exploring a whole lot of areas of 2.0, including government. He's well known in the Government 2.0 community and has been an active participant at Public Sphere, Bar Camp Canberra, New South Wales Public Sphere, Local Government Web Network Conference and Social Innovation Camp. And he was the head unorganiser, I love this term, of Us Now Sydney. Headshift is a specialist social business consultancy and development company which has rapidly emerged in UK and Europe primarily. And is very much an international company looking at using emerging technologies in a whole range of new contexts. So we're very fortunate to have James, who was recommended to us by Pia, which is extremely good recommendation indeed, and he'll talk to us about a wide range of issues today. Thank you, James.
Thank you. I just might mention as well that I've got Violet Bragg here in the audience as well from Headshift, so if you want to ask some questions later on, bail me up or also bail up Anne as well. I was actually having a look. It was really great, actually, on the website that you've got recordings and past presentations, which, I mean, in itself is a great example of Gov2.0. But it meant I could actually go in, have a look at what we talked about before, and I immediately thought, well, I'm not going to talk about Twitter, or not too much about Twitter, because there's obviously a focus that's being done on that. So, I mean, there's always some great benefits with sharing even simple information in a transparent way. What I thought I would try to do today around this topic of engaging the community with social media is actually to try and challenge maybe some assumptions or ideas you might hold about what social media is, and in particular how we actually go about engaging people with social media. And I want to draw a distinction, I guess, between the idea of publishing or communicating with social media and the actual idea of engaging people with social media. So a subtle difference there. Just to get us started, I thought, oh, how can I not provide some useless social media stats? So, actually, last night, there were 52,264 people following Hamish and Andy on Twitter, and then I clicked the follow button. So there's now 52,265. This is a good one. 24 hours of video is uploaded to YouTube every minute of the day, which is quite an astounding stat. And also... 106,809 people like MasterChef Australia on Facebook. These are all interesting statistics. And if you go looking, you'll find lots of social media statistics that primarily talk about the huge growth of this area. I guess the thing is, though, what do we actually do with that? Great, so there's 100,000 people that like MasterChef. What does that mean? How do we actually engage with these people? Do we want to engage with these people? And I'm sure Hamish and Andy are quite excited. They've got those 50,000 odd followers, but again, how do they do something useful with that? I mean, they've got a commercial interest, so I guess that's quite easy. They just need more followers to listen to their show, and they can sell more advertising. If you're in government, though, you've got really often completely different goals and objectives in mind. So what do we do with these sort of stats? Let's not worry about those stats for the moment. If you've heard me present before, and I know Pia and Anne has, of course, you know that I often like to put a bit of a historical spin. I'm really interested in how the history of society has been impacted by technology, how technology affects us. So I thought, I don't want to talk about Twitter. What I thought I might talk about was a very early form of Twitter. This is a notificator. I think back in sort of maybe Victorian times, sort of early last century, you could go to a train station in London, put a penny in the slot, write a message, And that message would work its way up the board and maybe stay there for a couple of hours. So if you're trying to meet friends and you perhaps didn't quite meet each other, you could leave a note saying, sorry, go on to the pub, see me at the Rose and Crown. So there's been these ideas of needing to communicate and using technology to communicate for quite some time. With the Novocator, though, I think it's quite interesting. I'm not really sure if this actually saw the light of day. It was an idea that was maybe before its time. And I think there's a real danger, actually, when we do look back and we look at technology and we look at the history of communication, and we can actually draw parallels with other tools like, you know, the telegraph, you know, was an early form of electronic communication, and some of the behaviours that came out of that technology. We can really get distracted by the technology itself. So as a bit of a counterpoint to that, I think it's worth thinking about the humble postcard. In itself, quite revolutionary, if you think about it. So originally, you had to write a letter. It cost a certain amount to send that letter, which for the average person, in those times when the postal service first started, would still be quite expensive. But a postcard was a really cheap and effective way to communicate with people. But what can you communicate in a postcard? There's often things about, you know, where have I been? Where am I going? We classically think these days of holiday postcards. There are also more risque postcards that appeared in the history of that communication tool, which again we can see parallels in what people do online as well. So I think actually rather than focusing on things like the Novocator, which probably didn't have a lot of impact, it's more important to think about the need that as humans we want to communicate. And if we can find a cheap and effective communication tool, like a postcard, we'll make really good use of them. And in fact, again, if you look at the postcard as a piece of technology, it has certain constraints. Actually, Anne and I were talking about this the other night, just saying how, you know, I'm sure you've all had friends who've sent you the postcard where the writing curls around the postcard to try and fit into the available space. And we see that behaviour with Twitter as well, which is interesting because Twitter is only really confined to those 140 characters because it actually started off as a tool designed for mobile phones to work on SMS. But that constraint has carried over into the web. The people who run Twitter could easily change that. They could give you the ability to give you more space. But it would be interesting to see how that would actually affect the utility of Twitter, how different, ways of communicating with Twitter, things like hashtags, might not have actually emerged had we not been constrained by the space. Okay? So the key thing here is to concentrate on the fact that it's about communication, and it's also about how the technology shapes how we communicate, and how we get around some of the constraints of that communication. For the rest of the what I'm going to talk about today, though, I'm not going to talk too much about Twitter, as I promised. What I want to do, though, is sort of look at the fear, uncertainty, the doubt, some of the myths around social media. And I think one of the big myths is this idea that anyone can pretty much go out, get onto social media, somehow affect change. Now, I think thinking of government and also the political world, the idea that somehow you can create a Facebook account or set up some kind of social media site and you can just go out there and influence people. I want to challenge some of that. On the other hand, though, I also want to challenge some of the ideas that people might have about who uses social media and maybe what level of influence it can have. So just bear with me as we go through this. And I'd love to sort of get questions or challenges as we go. I've already said to Pierre and Anne to heckle me as I present today. But yeah, if you want to sort of... Yeah, sorry.
We're going to be quiet.
Okay, so feel free to sort of ask me questions as we go. So the first thing I want to talk about is forgetting stereotypes. I think the big idea of social media, because it's online, involves computers and technology, that really it's all about teenagers maybe in their bedrooms playing World of Warcraft. Now, there's actually nothing wrong with World of Warcraft, but I think that's actually far removed from the truth. When you actually look at who's using online technologies, that demographic, you know, it's really easy to make assumptions about the demographic that goes online. We know actually it's a spread of people that goes online. Also, what I think is quite interesting from talking to people, not so much at the federal government level, but at the ACT local government level, is that when they've gone online to consult with people using online tools, they've actually found that they can reach out to demographics that normally they wouldn't be able to interact with. So if you think about this, if you run a traditional consultation, you invite people to a forum like this, and it's during the day, really you're actually limiting who can participate. If you go online, actually, you can tap into a demographic that's probably working, isn't mobile, maybe remote to the location, but has some kind of interest in it. you actually can invite more people in, which is a side of the issue around digital inclusion that we don't often hear about. The online environment can actually open up participation to different people. So we've really got to forget these stereotypes of who goes online and what they do online as well. It's very average people going online. Clay Shirky, I think, has already been quoted by Nicholas Gruen at past presentations, but really he has, I think, nutted out some of the key ideas or key concepts around social computing. And one of those is that, you know, only really gets interesting when it gets boring. So if you think back a decade, two decades, the power and utility of the mobile phone, I don't think we could have imagined what we'd do with it. But increasingly, we don't think twice about looking up a Google map, maybe checking a restaurant review, or doing, Anne was checking in on her flight last night using her iPhone, and she'll be able to just scan it as she goes through the boarding gate. These things are increasingly just part of our daily lives, and we don't think about it. And when that happens, you know, people are just using them. They're not thinking about it. Let's put this in a bit of a more of a political and government context, and because we've got an election, both my home state of New South Wales coming in the future and at a federal level, there'll be an election coming eventually around. I think it's interesting to look at what's happened in the UK. Mumsnet, and you mentioned the UsNow event that I was an unorganiser for. UsNow was a documentary that some of you may have seen, produced by the UK, just looking at new forms of government and participation. And Mumsnet was one of the examples they used in the UsNow documentary. UsNow actually popped up again during the recent UK elections because of the use of that forum, the attempted use of that forum by the political parties to engage with people. As the name suggests, Mumsnet is all about parents. It's where parents go to swap tips around about parenting. So these aren't teenagers talking about online gaming. These are adults. These are parents talking about issues that are really, really important to them. And obviously, if they're people in society, they've got a political view. This particular screenshot. Is a question from someone asking, what's the political position of Mumsnet? So just if you can't read that, I've seen many different users with different political views, but on MNTV video of David Cameron answering questions, there seem to be many anti-Labour posters behind him. Is this just because it was Cameron, or is this the positions of Mumsnet? Well, Mumsnet is just a forum, it's not a political organisation. But again, people are discussing politics, and there was a sort of a move, I guess, to call for certain family-friendly, child-friendly policies to be championed during the election. So that's back in February. I think it's interesting just to look at some of the research that's followed the British election, just looking at what the impact of social media has been. So 40% of UK voters said they were influenced to some degree by online campaigns. So that's all kinds of online digital media. So traditional websites, the websites of political parties, newspapers. When we actually get into the social media, 11% recall reading political information on social media and social networking sites. So a smaller percentage. However, that's a growing percentage. The 18 to 24 demographic is obviously generationally more active in social media, but it does extend through to the 25 and 34 year old age group as well, that they're engaging with political content on social media and social networks. I think what the big debate is social media just reflecting opinion? Or is actually changing opinion? To an extent, I suspect it's a combination of both. People are always going to make opinions. They're already having conversations in the pub. It's just that we're now doing some of this online and we get to observe some of it happening. But certainly, I think there's definitely an argument that it's an area that can't be ignored and it's only going to grow over time. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens here in Australia as some of our elections come around and to see whether we see the same sort of level of participation or whether we actually see a growing level of participation. So engaging the crowd. So this is what we really wanted to talk about. So that was engaging the community with social media. I chose this picture in particular because I think we've got this idea that we go online and there's this huge audience, this huge pool of potential people, again, that we can influence. And I really want to challenge that idea because, you know, a large group of people is actually quite hard. I think, you know, we can talk about the idea of groupthink, but if you think about going online, we've got all these potential eyeballs of people talking online. The idea is, as I said at the beginning, that we can go online, do some quirky YouTube video, and somehow you know, by magic almost, the opinion of all these people is just going to change. They're just going to fall in line and follow whatever we're saying. And I think that really sort of underestimates, you know, human intelligence and how society works. So I think by challenging this idea that we've got this huge crowd, I just want to start to focus in. Certainly you can engage with the crowd, but I think it's within certain limited circumstances. This is Quora, which is a new site that's causing a bit of a stir in the US. And essentially, it's a question and answer site. It's getting a bit of coverage because people are saying the quality of the answers is so good. But when you think about it, you know, it's a question and answer process. So I think even within in this room, we understand that basic concept. And I think it suggests that if you're going to engage a large group of people, the same even with Wikipedia to an extent, if you're going to engage a large group of people, the larger the group, the more structured the process you need. And you also need what we often talk about as being the game mechanics. What drives this process to make sure that people don't cheat, don't take advantage of it, so that actually people get the value out of that process. But in terms of social interaction, and while this site tries to sort of have this idea of people you might follow, people that you might friend, who might answer or ask questions that you're interested in, really when we talk about engagement, actual conversation, this site isn't about conversation. It's about asking a question from a group of people that you might maybe respect or admire or hold similar views of and actually get a good answer from. But in terms of actual engagement, it's actually not a very engaging platform. But it serves a useful purpose. It taps into that collective intelligence and quite a useful idea. We should also talk a little bit about Facebook, but instead I want to actually focus on, again, some of the emerging ideas in this space around social networking, where people are actually trying to get out of Facebook and get into online networks where they actually have more control over their own information, who has access to the information, who can watch the activities that go on in those social networks. Thinking about that crowd again, I think we've approached this idea of the online world saying, great, all these people, we can go in, we can somehow leverage what they're doing, what they're thinking, and somehow get some benefit for ourselves from that. And I think actually what we're seeing is people are starting to react to this idea that their public personal lives are being exposed online, and they're not actually getting any benefit from other people coming in. And whether they're using algorithms to try and come up with better advertising or for market research, people actually don't want that. So again, I think from both a government and a more of a political point of view, again, the idea that there's this big crowd of people and you can take advantage by tapping into what they're thinking about, people begin to challenge that idea. I think that sort of says actually if your whole strategy of online engagement is based on Facebook, you actually need to look a bit further and actually watch what's happening. So one social web is just one example of maybe three or four different initiatives where people are actually trying to create, as I said, more open networks where you can move between networks, where you actually own your own data, where you have better control over privacy, about who can access that information. And that's quite opposed to, I guess, the Facebook model. If you think about Facebook is a business. I know certain commentators are talking about Facebook being a utility, and maybe we should manage it like a utility, like the electricity or the water service. But they are actually a commercial organisation. They're only letting you participate in that platform because ideally they can make a profit from it. And I guess the community, particularly the open source community, is saying that that's actually not good enough. We actually want it for our own utility, not for your utility. So yeah, it's worth, I think Dysphoria, Appleseed I think is another one, One Social Web, I picked that because it had the nicer looking screenshot, but there are a whole bunch of different sort of people looking at different approaches to the social networks and not making them closed gardens where you have to play and only play within that social network. And actually, in fact, you can take it away with yourself. Create your own social network. The other big area that I want to challenge is this idea that, again, by being online, we only want to interact online. In fact, what we're increasingly seeing is that location, face-to-face interaction, is an important component. So there's this idea maybe that we have real lives and virtual lives. In fact, it's a continuum. You know, we're all physical beings here. It's just that we have to go online to communicate. We leave maybe footprints, digital footprints of things we're doing online. We actually are hybrid animals. We live in both the virtual and the real world. So this is Foursquare. Has anyone heard of Foursquare? Anyone actively use it? Okay, so you're not the mayor of Parliament House? No.
Someone called Ben.
Didn't
I check? I don't think I'll ask him.
I wonder if Kevin knows. Okay. So what Foursquare is all about is on a mobile device, and using GPS within a mobile device, you can basically sort of check in and tell people, you know, I've been to this cafe, I've been to Parliament House. And as you do more activities, as you check in more often, the person who checks in at that location can become the mayor. And there are different sort of things you can win. Part of the idea is that also if it's a business that you're checking into, like a cafe, is there maybe some kind of business model where they can offer you special deals, free coffees, free meals. Again, I hope we're talking about this, that actually, that commercial focus is perhaps not actually understanding what people want. What's the actual utility to people? It's fun. Yeah, it's about status. They might actually just want to be recognised walking into the local cafe, not be given a free drink. So it's really important not to misunderstand why and how people want to engage. But again, this is all about building some game mechanics around a location-based device that increasingly people have with them, turning it into a bit of a game. But again, it's all focused on about association with a physical location, and the fact that you can network with people who are in that same location. They might want to join you for a coffee if you're going to a cafe, for example. So this is very much about real-world face-to-face. It's just that we're using the digital tools to actually increase the level of interaction and make new contacts. Just another example as well. People might be familiar with this idea of citizen journalism or hyper-local news. So Street Corner is a site I came across recently. I was at a launch of something called Para Connect in Parramatta in Sydney the other week. It's a sort of an NBN-inspired initiative by the local council there. And they had a bit of a launch night with a panel discussion about some of the opportunities around the digital technologies and the high-speed broadband network, what it's going to bring. And in fact, the only journalist or pseudo-journalist that I spoke to was a citizen reporter from Street Corner. In fact, when I've gone back subsequent to the event, the only reporting I've really seen about this event has been through this citizen journalist who's written an article for the Western Sydney sort of site of Street Corner. So in terms of engaging with the community, again, we've been focused on this idea of big media, big social media. You've got to be on these big sites to get noticed. But in fact, sites like this are actually targeted at specific geographic communities and the things that interest that particular community. So ParaConnect, for some reason, wasn't able to attract the attention of big media. But it doesn't mean that the local community has to miss out. I mean, the implications of this, I think, are fairly obvious, that if you only are talking to big media about local issues, you may actually be missing the audience that you need to engage with. So you've got to look, I guess, a bit more broadly and see where people are actually engaging with information and news and engage with them at that local level. Finally, live local, which again is all about encouraging people to reduce their impact on the environment by buying goods locally, but also maybe having a go at growing their own veggies in their backyard. So it's all about reducing your carbon footprint on the environment by sourcing things locally. So, really, as the name suggests, live local. It's very much about local communities. And this is real world stuff. As you can just see from the things down here, rainwater tanks, garage sales. This is real world stuff. This is everyday stuff that we all worry about, that we're all involved with. This isn't about going online for the sake of going online. This is about going online because people want to work together to achieve a positive social outcome. Which brings me to another point. People may ask, why do we want to bother going online? Is anyone there? And I think, there's that train sort of paradox. The train company says, we've visited the train station at 3:30 in the afternoon. There's no one there, so we won't actually put a train service in. Well, obviously, no one's going to go to the train station if there's no train service. So if you base your argument on the fact that, I'm not going to engage online because I can't see anyone engaging already, it's sort of chicken and egg here. You've actually sometimes got to create the space, create the opportunity for people to engage, rather than waiting for evidence that they actually are there already engaging online, because you might not have been talking about the issue that interests someone. There are a whole number of reasons why people might choose not to engage online. They may be sitting there lurking in the background, just waiting for the opportunity to have their say, contribute something useful. But if you don't provide that opportunity, or even go and find the right platform, the right train station, where people are, you're never actually going to be able to engage with anyone. This is an interesting site as well. I said I won't talk about Twitter, but this is actually a site for Coffs Harbour. And it's actually running, it says at the top there, running on some free software called StatusNet. So StatusNet is an open source version of Twitter. You can set up your own Twitter-like service with StatusNet and actually run your own private Twitter community. So here's a group of people that aren't necessarily on Twitter, but they're actually doing the same microblogging conversations. And this is all focused on a particular geographic area, so Coffs Harbour in this instance. I've come across quite a few different communities. Some might be around a location, some might be around a particular topic, some are just around a group of like-minded people. But note that they've deliberately chosen to almost take themselves out of Twitter and to use their own community site, but with all the same capabilities that we see in Twitter. So again, it's really important, as I said, about being on the right platform. If you're on Twitter looking for this Coffs Harbour community, you're probably not going to find them. You've actually got to go to them and engage with them on their terms, which is really what they're saying. We're communicating through microblogging for our own benefit. We're not here to share this information with you. This is for us. So if you want to talk to them, you need to go there and engage with them there. Luckily, with StatusNet, it's quite interesting. You can federate, getting a bit technical here, but you can federate between StatusNet sites and Twitter and other social tools. So we can bring them together. As I said, these people have that choice of creating that community, and you may not know it's there. Ravelry is one that quite interests me as well, talking about sort of more niche communities. Does anyone here knit? I don't knit. We've got a few knitters. Have you heard of Ravelry?
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me, Wade, because this is, I guess, a leading site in that area.
I only knit squares.
You only knit squares.
But it's still good.
You have to register to have a look. Okay, so it's a sort of semi-closed community, but it's
showing knitting.
Yeah, but it's for knitters. But it's really interesting because it's a combination of social network, but it's also quite practical. You can share patterns and reviews, and some people actually even sell patterns and I guess other knitting-related products through Ravelry. So here is this actually a brilliant niche community of people that are interested in knitting, but again, they're not out there necessarily blogging in public. They're not necessarily out on Twitter or Facebook doing different things. They're interested in knitting, and that's where they go to talk about knitting. Now, how do you engage with that community? Maybe you can't, unless you're trying to engage with them around some issue to do with knitting. But again, it comes back to this point. People aren't going online because they're waiting there, nothing to do, going, oh, I wish someone from government or a politician would come and engage with me. That's not why they're going online. They're going online because they can do things that interest them for their own benefit. So it's really critical that we understand that. Which brings me to how do we go about engaging people? I was really lucky last year with Headshift to be involved with the Government 2.0 Task Force project, which we call Project 8. Sounds very secret, squirrel, it's not. But it was a good project. We actually got to work on developing some guidelines for people, particularly in the federal public service, to help them plan and strategise how they might engage with people online. So the whole report, the guidelines, has been published under a Creative Commons licence. So if those of you in the room are actually working in the public service, you can go online, download them, read them, you can even prove them and upload them again. But they're there for you to use. But I'm just going to talk through one of the key models we produced for that report. Because community management also is this idea of we're going to engage with some people online. How do we actually go about doing that? What are the activities we need to do? And it's a combination of both a process. A community manager can also be a person or a group of people with specific roles around engaging with that community of people. They may not be the specialists who understand the particular topic, but they're specialists, if you like, they're kind of online facilitators. And there's some discrete roles around moderation, facilitation, and also what we call digital curation, which is kind of collecting, I guess, online content that people create and editing it in the sense of bringing the important or most interesting content to the front. So with our online engagement framework around community management, we actually identified four broad areas, what we call genre of online engagement. So this is for the public sector. There's not really a political dimension to this model, but you know, some of the principles still apply. So we said that there are things around identifying problems or opportunities or future issues. That's almost like a consultation, but without a specific outcome in mind. We're exploring ideas. Then you've got the more deliberate policy consultation, and if you're game, policy collaboration, where we get people to co-create new policies. Customer service and service delivery. So even at the federal level, there are some agencies that are directly involved with delivering services to the community. And of course, what we might classically think around social media marketing, so campaigns, promotion, communication, public health messages, for example. So they're kind of the four broad areas that the public service might want to use social media and social networks for online engagement. Now, there's some well-established processes around consultation that we've borrowed, and we've created a bit of a circular process here. And one of the key steps is around listening and identifying the audience. So again, if you're going to engage with people online, really your first step is to go and find out, well, are they already online? Where are they already talking? Where are they? What tools are they using? And how might that actually impact how we want to engage with them? Because again, I think the assumption is, we want to engage online, let's put up a website and tell everyone to come to us. We'll dictate the terms, by the way, and we'll engage with you. Okay? If you actually go out and look and listen, you may find that's actually not going to be the case. They may not want to come to your site. They may already be somewhere talking about the issue that you want to address. That can become complicated if maybe they're already discussing it in a negative way, and you're going to have to come up with maybe strategies for either ignoring or dealing with that. But really, it's really important you go out and listen. Then really, it's about once you know who you want to engage, and again, as I said, this is really following a more of a traditional consultation process. You know, you've got to sort of communicate to people. What's the value proposition? I want to engage with you. What are you going to get out of it? Not what am I going to get out of it particularly, but what are you going to get out of that participation? In a government context, if I provide input into a policy consultation online, what's the impact going to be? If I spend time adding my comments, what can I expect to see happen with my ideas? If you need to tell people, set expectations. Then you can begin to consult and involve. As I said, if you're brave enough, you may move to a more collaborative model. Set up a wiki page, let them write the policy. And I know Pierre's got a lot of experience with the public sphere process of doing that, and it can work. But it does take some active community management to actually get to that point where that can happen. But the other issue is, though, and again, this is about engaging people, addressing their needs and concerns, their interests, is that as we wind back down, we don't just say, oh, thanks a lot. Thanks for all the stuff you've given to us. We actually need to consult back to them, communicate back to them, and listen again. What was the response? Did they actually enjoy the process? Did they feel that their expectations were met? So there's I guess in a way, it's kind of a respectful process. We're using people's time. We want to engage online. We've got to understand what they want. Where do they want to engage? We don't just take. We actually need to give quite a lot back. Which also brings me again to the point you might have been picking up with some of the examples. There's this issue of what I call big and small social media. Today, a lot of the hype around online engagement, again, particularly in the government 2.0 space, has been about engaging through big social media. Let's get on Twitter, let's get on Facebook, let's get on YouTube. And it's not that there isn't a place for that, but again, if you're actually looking for impact, if you're actually looking to engage, not just, I guess, broadcast or communicate, you actually need to be a little bit more subtle in, as I said, understanding where people are and go and engage with them on their terms. So if you are planning or if you're interested in engaging with people online, go and look at Twitter, go and look at Facebook, go and look at YouTube. Then you need to step out and look a bit further. Actually see where else people might be participating. Don't be obsessed by the big end of the social media spectrum. I don't know if you can pick up maybe a slight Pommy accent, but I was born in the UK. And I recently came across a forum for expat Poms. I've actually made a few comments on it, you know, given a bit of advice to people who might be thinking of coming out here. But actually, I can't keep up the number of questions and comments that flow through this forum. Yeah, you probably never hear about it. And the types of questions are relevant to government. It's people asking about taxation. It's asking about how they deal with organisations like Centrelink. It's asking about where should they live? How does the school system work? Where do I enrol? Will my, will this conviction for speeding in the UK affect my chances of getting in? What's Canberra like? All those sorts of questions are going on within that community. But it's not on Facebook, it's not on YouTube, it's within this specific site. This is also from the Project 8, so that Government 2O Task Force project I mentioned, where we tried to provide a bit of a framework to try and help people understand a bit more about the different technologies, and particularly this idea of not just small and big social media, but kind of useful tools versus social networks. So what we've got is some foundational tools. That's more about if you're creating a hub for your initiative of what you might start with. As we start to move out, we've got this distinction between the idea of vertical specific tools, and it's a little bit sounds a bit technical, and this idea of online networks. What we're actually trying to do is distinguish between the fact that there are lots of useful tools you can use that might be cheaper, faster, more effective for what you want to do in terms of communicating online. So for example, you want to host a video as part of your online engagement strategy. I guess the default position would be YouTube. Well, actually, no. Are you trying to engage with YouTube because you've got a network, a social network of people around video? Or do you just want to broadcast some video? Okay, so YouTube doesn't have to be your default position. In fact, I've probably got a criticism of YouTube that there's actually not a lot of community in YouTube. If you go and look at the comments, it's more like walking into a pub brawl than into a forum of people who want to exchange views. Okay, that's just my opinion. But you don't actually have to default to some of these social networks if you just want the utility of publishing content. What this doesn't get into then is talking about this this distinction between specific social networks, because we simply can't identify them all. And I guess again there's that default position. We'll go with the brand name networks because we're familiar with them. But in fact, as I said, the people you want to engage with may not be on any of those online networks we've identified here. There's some other site that just isn't on that immediate radar. So you've got to look a bit further. These sites though, YouTube, SlideShare, Delicious, Flickr, Twitter, Facebook, they can often give you, signposts that might point you to where people are participating. Because often people have multiple kind of social networks that they're involved with. And I guess things like Twitter and Facebook, with the ability to log into other sites with a single identity, can help with that. So by all means, start there. And if you find an active community, yeah, engage with it. But
all members of the Joint Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade.
That's not good.
So,
these sites can give you clues, they can give you hints of where else to look, because people are sharing links. But again, you just got to go the extra step, look a bit further, see where people are. Just talking as well about Government 2.0 in particular as well. I've been talking a lot about that external facing environment of social media. It's about us going out and engaging with people online. One of the things that Headshift in particular we want to highlight with people is that it's actually difficult to be social externally if you're not social internally. And this is a huge problem, not just for government, but across all industries. If you think about this, a company can advertise itself as having excellent customer service, but actually the moment of truth is when you walk into the shop front or you make a telephone call. And we all would have had these experiences with big companies in banking, and telephone companies, internet companies. You ring up with a problem, and what happens? You wait on hold. You get someone who can't actually deal with your problem. They promise to ring you back, and they don't. So this company can be on social media. They can make all the noise they like about delivering good customer service. But in fact, if internally they're unable to collaborate and deliver that service, really that social media is not worth anything. It's really end-to-end. Whatever you say online, that image you want to project, the promises you make online have got to flow through the system. Now the issue is that, you might say, but hang on, we're just sort of out there marketing and branding. The Channel Tunnel in the UK is a classic example where they were using Twitter to market holidays, and then they had service problems. Now guess what, their customers didn't care that Twitter channel was just there for marketing. If the company, the Channel Tunnel train company said, no, Eurostar said, no, it's just for marketing, you can't engage with us. Customers, I don't care, I'm stuck, get me home. Okay, so you can't just assume that social media is against this one-way opportunity for you to tap in and market your message. Guess what, people actually might speak back to you. They might actually have real issues and questions they want to see answered. If you can't answer them, that whole image you've put forward, those promises you've made have just fallen away. And that applies equally to government as it does to the commercial sector. Now, so the challenge there, though, is bringing some of the social tools inside your organisation. And what I mean by that is these are communication tools that allow people in those organisations to collaborate and communicate and share information quickly without getting bogged down in organisational silos, rigid workflow processes that make you work through particular steps. I was signing up for a broadband internet card the other day. I won't mention the company name, but I watched the poor guy as he typed my name and address. Oh, you're not a current customer, no. Just bear with me. He entered my name, date of birth, telephone number, address about 6 times just to get into their system to make it work. Okay? You think about the internet and your experience of signing up for a service, buying a product online. It's streamlined. It's easy. It's efficient. You can probably go online and ask questions and get an answer very quickly. One client of Headshift, actually, they had a goal of answering online inquiries within about an hour or 2 hours. But they actually found that their own customers could answer questions faster than they could. So, in fact, they had to change their strategy of actually working with their customers to answer questions from other customers. They had to stop assuming that they were the font of all knowledge and the channel of all communication. So it's going to require changes inside if you're going to be able to engage online effectively. There's also a further step we can go to, which is actually pushing government out of the way entirely. There's some great things happening around social innovation. There are some ideas that I'm seeing more from the UK in particular around service design or service co-design, where we get people to participate in the design of community services. And that's not about digital services. But if we look at the online world, this is actually a picture from Social Innovation Camp that took place in March this year here in Australia. It's an idea that came from the UK, it's been to Eastern Europe, sort of making its way around the world. I think the Kiwis are interested in doing a social innovation camp as well. The idea of social innovation camp is pick a social issue, and not necessarily a big picture issue, but something specific, something that are bite-sized that can be tackled and perhaps can be enabled or assisted through the use of social computing tools, social media, social networking. Brainstorm that for a bit, and then come together on a weekend, get a whole bunch of enthusiastic developers, people who know about the community issues, other facilitators and consultants, designers, and let's build a prototype there and then. 2 days, come up with a prototype. So, really exciting process to go through. This is a beta of a site called Two Bobsworth. It's one of the winners from Social Innovation Camp in Australia, and it's still a site that's an organisation even, a tool that's emerging, but they're going through all the right processes of setting themselves up as a non-profit organisation. You know, it's a serious venture. What Two Bobsworth would do is, like, I've got an hour to spare every weekend. What can I do in my local community that might help someone? So it's a bit of a marketplace for volunteer opportunities, but on a very small scale. Yeah, I can't volunteer to come in once a week to help out at the local op shop. I can't do Meals on Wheels, I can't commit to that, but I've got an hour or a couple of hours and I could do something, maybe once a month or once a year. So it's an exchange for those micro volunteering opportunities. And I guess Two Bobsworth are stepping in because no one else has done it. They've identified a problem and they're now trying to fill that gap, but they're doing it on their own without the assistance of government or, I guess, traditional community service organisations. Now, eventually, they're going to need to engage with them to get them on board, but essentially, this is being driven by the public, and they're trying to solve a problem or fill a gap. If we want to look at a more mature solution, and Pierre and Kate, you would have heard me talk about this over and over again, but for me, this is still one of my favourite examples, which is patient opinion from the UK. Patient opinion is an interesting both an interesting organisation and an interesting service. It's effectively a feedback tool for people who've been through specialist services in the UK's health system. And what it does is provides a channel for you to provide feedback. Now, when they were talking about this idea, the health services there were naturally quite worried. They thought, oh, you know, we're just going to get people complaining about everything. And what are we going to do? Why? We don't want to hear this. We don't want to hear these complaints necessarily. One of the amazing things has been that 70% of the feedback has been positive. So one of the things they sort of filled the gap with is the fact that people don't always just want to complain about government services. They actually often want to compliment people. They recognise when they've been looked after, when there's been a good outcome. Of course, 30% are still problems. And they may be real problems, or they just may be people whinging. But the important thing is that patient opinion is actually an independent self-sustaining non-profit organisation. It's not part of the NHS directly. They have a business model, just like any other Web 2.0 venture, and it's actually based on a pretty common strategy, which is about data. What patient opinion does, it provides both stories and narrative about specific issues, but overall, they can also provide statistics, which hospital or which specialist service is getting the most complaints, what areas are there for improvement. So the funding model is actually a small number of, I think, NHS trusts at this point provide them with funding because they want the data and the information. You might say, but aren't the hospitals doing that already? Well, the GPs who are behind this idea identified the fact that hospitals are really good at collecting facts. They know how many people over the age of 40 had a hip replacement on the right-hand side in the month of August. What they can't tell you is, were they happy? You know, did it improve their quality of life? Was the experience at hospital good? Were there other complications? Were there other issues that the family were upset about, perhaps when they're helping an elderly relative go through surgery? None of that information is collected. Often because if you're in hospital, something's going on, your focus isn't providing feedback to the hospital at that point in time. It's only sometime later that you might turn around and go, actually, I was really, really unhappy, or I'm really happy with that. And they've provided a channel for that feedback to happen. What they do actually is also make sure the feedback goes to the hospital and also the local MP. So again, they're just creating some visibility, but also it means that people can see what's in it for them. If it was just a place where you could go and whinge and nothing happened, people wouldn't use it. But they've got some assurance that there's a third party watching over the process, making sure that feedback is responded to and that something potentially will happen from it. So that's kind of, you know, this idea now that you can engage people with social media, but it doesn't have to be necessarily government, political parties that are engaging. There may be other third parties that might want to get involved, but also the community actually has the ability, using these technologies, to also fill some of those gaps. I guess if there's one final message I want to leave you with, yeah. So danger, beware of pedestrians. Let's not trample on the people who are participating online. It's about engagement with social media. That's the thing you've really got to focus on. You're trying to engage people. You just happen to be using social media because there is some, I guess, either convenience or potential opportunity that using social media provides that traditional forms of engagement don't offer. So it can either augment traditional forms of engagement and communication, but it may also generate whole new methods. We, as part of the task force, we also ran a pilot engagement for the Australian Law Reform Commission. And some of the feedback we received from that agency was that they'd always received written communication for consultations. They'd also always run workshops and forums to collect feedback. What they actually were surprised by was that they got a different style of feedback through the online channel. They actually not just got factual information, they also got the stories and the reasons why particular people were putting forward certain ideas or recommendations or complaints about the issue they were looking at. So online engagement actually can do something even more than we've traditionally been able to do through other forms of engagement. So kind of got to open your eyes to the opportunity. Go to where people are. Understand why they might want to engage with you, not about what you can get from them. And if you can answer that, provide something useful, then you can actually achieve some engagement with social media. Thank you. Any questions?
Right, we have got an opportunity for questions now. Thank you very much for that presentation, James. I've been tweeting, in case you're wondering what I was doing, about the presentation. We have got an opportunity for questions. A little bit of time, so please indicate if you've got one. Okay, I'm going to start. this point about, you finished on a really strong point. Citizens have already chosen their places where they want to engage with other people. I really think this is an important point where it is about engaging on the terms that the citizens have defined for themselves, rather than seeing social media as another marketing vehicle. Can you reflect a little more on that, and particularly from the perspective of the public sector stroke politics, because I get really concerned about it being seen as another marketing avenue as opposed to a different way of approaching engagement and a relationship between government, citizens they serve, and indeed politicians and constituents which I serve too.
I really think that it's worthwhile situating some of this looking at that particular point by situating it back in the real physical world. So if you busted into the local pub and stood on a chair and started shouting at, you know, your policies, you wouldn't get a very good reaction. If you walked in, though, and said, guess what, I'm your local senator. I'm going to be around for a bit. You might see me dropping in from time to time. Buy me a drink if you want. Let's chat politics.
Do I buy you a drink?
Yeah, or you buy me a drink.
Yeah.
And you came back every so often, and you sort of went up to a group and had a bit of a chat and went away, and then you came back and had a bit more of a chat. Guess what? You've probably built some rapport. People might not even agree with you, but I bet you get some respectful dialogue through that process. And I think that's the important issue. It could still be a venue that you host, but you know, it's about taking the time. I think there's an idea that's an instant hit. We just get out there on social media, build rapport because I've got a connection with someone, and then I can tell them what I think. You've actually got to take the time to build up a relationship, and that's what it's about, relationships. And we're assuming that, again, the online world isn't about real-world relationships. But in fact, when you bust in online, it is, yeah. People have got existing relationships. There's potential to create new relationships, which is, I guess, the really wonderful experience I've had is connecting up with like-minded people and the things that interest me, particularly around this space.
Yeah.
And it's a global but also a local network. And we spend a lot of time having coffee with people we know, but also on Twitter and via my blog with people that I've never met. And I hope one day I might have the opportunity to, but I've never met in person. But again, it's all about building relationships, and you just can't storm in and start broadcasting your message.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the sort of tools we have to work out where our stakeholders actually are. Because I know rightly or wrongly there's a lot of fear at the moment about government surveillance, government data retention. I guess the e-health debate shows up how fearful people are about their information online. So what sorts of tools are appropriate to use to find out where people might be going?
Yeah, well, actually, I think there's sort of two dimensions to this. There are plenty of tools, and we're certainly finding that not all the tools go to the places where you might need to be. So you've actually got to experiment and test out and see what they're listening to. However, we also have, I suppose, some ethical standards around we only listen to public conversations. We don't create fake identity to log into a private network so we can then listen. I guess if we felt the need to do that, we'd actually ask permission to go in and say that we were trying to find out if people are interested in this particular topic, engage with them that way. So there's two sides to this. In terms of tools, though, there are a heap of listening options or social media monitoring options, and that starts with Google. You know, you can set up alerts and different things and look over time to see where people are at. There are also other tools that will, I guess, scan the online environment, different forums, different social media sites, and will try and give you some clues to that message. However, again, no quick hits. Sometimes you've got to watch because... So we've got a client that's in the healthcare products industry. They deal a lot with teenagers with skin problems. And the types of conversation that those teenagers are having about these skin problems are probably not what the average marketing person would have gone out looking for originally. And it's only through listening and seeing what that community of users is doing that you start to get attuned, I guess, to the language and what they're interested in. And then you can also, you know, you can go further. You start to get those signposts of where else they might be, and you can explore it. So, I mean, it's very much a kind of a research-based approach of going out and looking for evidence and following the trail rather than having these big tools that would just suck information up, because often it's either you don't know what you don't know or it's not reliable. So it just takes a bit of time to go and look. But there are tools that will help you. You just got to pick the right one. Does that... Yep.
Just wondering what you think about, you mentioned then with people creating false profiles. I know in marketing a lot of companies now will pay either people within their company or external groups to actually go on and blog on websites or load up product reviews, sort of as a marketing strategy and an advertising strategy. And I'm just wondering what you think about that and whether there are ways that sites can stop people who aren't genuinely going on to review the product from actually doing that.
Yeah, so actually part of my background is working in knowledge management inside organisations. And you know, going back a decade, we'd have very simple schemes. We would say, you upload a document and we'll give you a point. You get 10 points, we'll give you a prize. This March, we had a bunch of very smart accountants, and they obviously got together and went, look, we've got a big report. If you submit a chapter, we all get a point. One problem they had, though, was that we actually had a human sort of knowledge manager who was managing that flow of content into the system. And at first she didn't notice, but then eventually she put two and two together and went, hang on, we've got to change the game rules here. So if you have a purely mechanical site where people can do stuff, and that's what spammers take advantage of, yeah, people can astroturf, so that's the term people use for those sort of fake comments, fake personas. But if you actually have people involved, and in fact you can often enlist your own community to do that, but you've basically got to have people listening for that behaviour. Maybe some academics might come up with some kind of algorithm to look for that, and I guess that's part of Google's strength, is its global search algorithm. But it's a bit different when you've got a community and you've got people coming online to engage, because it might not be visible to some of these tools. So you're going to have to follow a combination of techniques. But often, you know, the best technique, the most sustainable technique, is to involve your community. And they'll spot people, and they'll tell people. And actually, one of the personal frustrations I've had with some sites is, you know, a spammer or someone who comes on and they're abusing the network. Who can I complain to? How can I get rid of them? So, you know, you've got to have mechanisms for doing that. But that's part of that community management process and the community management role.
And James, it's bordering on illegal in some aspects as well. And when they get sprung, outed, the reaction of the community is very strong against, if it's a brand that's gone in somewhere, and there's been a number of them that have done it, and there are agencies that promote it, the reaction, the pushback is far worse. Now you have crisis management on your hands. It's a dangerous game to be playing, because the public don't like to be spoofed. They don't like to feel they've been sucked in and made an idiot out of. So particularly in a political context, it would be absolutely like treading on landmines. You know, you really wouldn't want to do it.
There's people behind those usernames. We've got to remember there's real people behind them.
Yeah. Other questions? Can I throw another one at you about the back-end resources? You know, it reminds me when we all started using email and promoted our email addresses, and then it's like really frightening, people started emailing us. And it was really hard to deal with from a resource perspective. And I remember saying, wow, we've got to treat this like normal mail. And that was like really unusual. Same now, except it's more resource intensive, because it's not going into a correspondence flow or system. It is about engagement. It's about knowing and understanding and being part of it. What are your thoughts on the reorganisation that needs to occur behind the scenes to get it? We've done this in my office by allowing all of my staff to blog and respond and comment on my website under their own names, so not trying to pretend to do anything, but maximise our ability in a political office to respond. But can you give us a sort of a bigger perspective on it?
I think in a way you're actually responding in one of the most sensible ways, is you've got to divvy up responsibility. Unless you actually have someone who's full-time just doing that, if you've got a sizable community of people you can engage with, it's going to be very difficult. So you've really got to be able to engage all the people that are working with you. And even beyond that, other volunteer supporters that might want to be engaged as well. And that can be on a formal or informal basis. I think the other issue gets back to that whole social on the inside, social on the outside. What we're saying is that, if you try to centralise everything through one gatekeeper, it is really difficult to resource because it takes a level of effort. I think the trick, though, also, and I was talking to a federal agency about this who have a service delivery angle, there is a cost for them every time someone calls the call centre, which is actually outsourced to another agency. So there's some simple maths there that actually, though, you can balance the books a bit. If you can, but overall, perhaps get more efficiencies. So you might have to shift some resources around, do things a little bit differently, but because the risk is that you have all these traditional channels which have the same volume, you're actually just attracting other volumes, so you've actually got to take on more and more people. So we've got to replumb some of the organisational structures and flows to make things work. I think it's harder though in sort of your situation, that in terms of how much resource and what flow can you remove to compensate.
Yeah, and I think it's analogous to any small business or very small, you know, five person outfit too.
Mm. I think what you can do is also set expectations with people about how far, you know, tell people up front, and I suspect you've got some community rules, but you know, what the moderation process is, how fast you're going to respond. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if you put something up that your spam detector's red flag, I'm sorry, if it's sort of at midnight you've posted a comment, you know, Pierre's not going to be in until 9 o'clock to actually clear it. You can't expect there to be a faster response. So you can manage expectations as well.
It's also that curation role that we're seeing coming through more. So rather than having to respond to every single piece that comes through, there'll be themes. And it's that ability to sort of capture the essence of the theme and write a response or sort of editorial comment with it and say, thanks, we've had heaps of comments like this.
Yeah.
So it acknowledges and that's a new role coming up that more and more companies are starting to identify.
Yeah. Probably the other thing as well is whether the conversation is taking outside of your own site or your own web presence. It's not to panic as well when things are happening. You know, it's the what we're talking about, the Barbara Streisand effect. That actually someone's complaining about something, but in fact, in the scheme of things, sometimes you're better off just letting them have their rant and ignoring them. And either that community, that location will come into play, which we've seen with an organisation where someone was, an amateur photographer was saying that their photo had been used without compensation.
Yeah.
In fact, they hadn't understood the terms of their contract with the image bank.
Right.
Okay. So while the local company here in Australia was trying to work out how to respond, in fact, there's a Flickr community came in and said, hey mate, you're wrong.
Got no grounds.
Yeah. So sometimes, again, that community will dive in for you. But you've got to not panic and go, oh, we've got to respond to this. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? But just take a breath and see how things actually flow.
Yes. James, I wonder, am I wrong here? Is confidentiality pretty much a limitation of Web 2.0? When you want to get engagement, you want to get ideas floating on something, but you do have issues of things needing to remain secret or certain issues needing to remain sort of confidential.
Yep.
Is there a way to still benefit from 2.0 without...
Definitely. And I've seen some bad examples where a secure site has been set up for online engagement, but the rules that you... or the book or the patterns, the social computing patterns that we might see of Web 2.0 sites that we interact with, somehow when you get through a login for a government sort of sponsored consultation, for example, those rules are let go. Oh, you're inside our domain now, so we'll have a really bad user experience and all that sort of thing. You can apply a lot of the ideas internally. I'll tell you why, because a lot of companies are employing the same ideas internally as well. And we can manage it in a secure way, but it certainly is a challenge, particularly around, you know, again, service delivery, you know, tax office, other agencies that are dealing with personal information. But I think one of the issues is also the transition, that you can actually grade things and have a very social, free-flowing, open, transparent kind of conversation with someone. But the point is that, look, actually, you've got some specific questions. We need to sort of move you into this area now, or we need to sort of, you know, do something in a more secure way. We've just got to manage that, but it's not... we've just got to do it better, I think, really, is the key thing. So just an example, I registered for an online consultation. I got given an obscure username. When I logged in, everyone else had an obscure username. And you could click on their username to see their profile, but that was blocked. I'm assuming only the internal staff could see it. I won't mention the name of the consultation, but it was, for the context of what they were consulting on, it was quite ironic that we weren't actually able to even see each other. And I think they were just taking that privacy concern too far in the context of that consultation. So, yeah, I think it's about designing that user experience so it flows and it works well. And it's also being practical, or I guess realistic, about the privacy concerns, because you can really overstate the needs to protect privacy when it's not necessary to that level.
Other questions? Because you'll never guess, I've got another one. look, it's a technical one. It's about electronic record keeping. Now, I know this is an issue for corporates as much as it is for the public sector. How do you have a conversation of substance and meaning using social media and still comply with the standards of record keeping in both the public and private sector? What are your thoughts on that?
Difficult.
Yeah, I know.
So I think there's issues like who owns that content. It's another issue. Then there's the technical question, how do we actually capture it?
Yeah.
Again...
And should it be captured?
Yeah.
Well, that's
that's
my argument with some of them, like the pub example.
Yeah.
Would you capture what you said in the pub in an indirect conversation?
Yeah.
Just because we're doing it online, it's in a text format, so perhaps it is more transportable.
Yeah.
Does it matter?
Yeah.
So
maybe it's in this where you move from this environment to this environment, that comes with some sort of codification of record keeping.
One of the issues in, say, the public sector, where I've had a lot more to do with record keeping, has been that it's actually it's kind of a user issue that, okay, how do you determine what is a record? If you can't, let's keep everything. And that's great when you've got a banded system. Email, your file shares, and you can capture everything. We've got a problem with going online is one, the data volumes are growing,
yeah.
And two, there is so much what we call the transitory information, that if you captured all that, I know that was it the library, the national, the US are capturing all the Twitter content. That's actually text. That's not too bad. You can compress that.
That's a story.
Yeah. But images, sound, that's going to be really hard. But I'm kind of with Anne as well. It's worth, I think, posing to people, why don't we record every government conversation? Government agencies are using IP telephony, so it's just data. Let's capture that. Hang on. Let's put microphones in every meeting room. Why don't we capture that? I think we know instinctively that there is a distinction.
Yeah.
But when you come to do it online, it's very hard to know is that a record or not.
Mm. I think this is a live issue at the moment, though, as agencies contemplate where they're going with Gov 2.0, and it's potentially one of the, like you say, the hard questions that becomes a blockage or a barrier to taking the next step.
That's right.
And it sort of links with IP and copyright coming with it, because we've got conversations happening perhaps in a closed group on LinkedIn. It's really, really valuable. Let's take that piece that we just got there and let's publish it here, but hang on, that's not mine. It was under different terms. What right do I have to capture that?
Yeah. Well, we might have to do another lecture on electronic record keeping in the Gov 2.0 environment. Are there any further questions for James before we wrap up the session? James, did you want to...
No, look, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to come and talk. It's a subject that NSHIP works with a range of clients, commercial and public sector and the non-profit sector. We actually think government and non-profit are actually a lot of the innovators in this space.
Yeah.
So don't be too hard on yourselves. The commercial sector is often a lot more risk-averse for commercial reasons. But you guys in many ways are leading the way. Risk management is always the issue, but we've got to be practical, sensible. People want to engage online. So we've just got to have a go and explore and work out some of these issues. But it's a slightly different way of thinking. I know there are challenges with that, but I think what we've seen, again, public sphere is still there as a really good experiment and process that we can show. We can try these things out, road test them, and then take them to a broader audience and sort of make them more routine and everyday.
Thank you. Can I just thank James again? He was been a terrific thought leader in this space. To Roxanne, as you are, with the innovation and the work you're doing here at the Parliamentary Library and the Parliamentary website, and I know the huge investment of your vision for where that needs to go. I'm just privileged to be part of this. I'm really sorry I wasn't here to formally introduce you. That comes with the job when that bell goes. But this is an important issue, and congratulations to James for what you've achieved and sharing your thoughts with us today. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming.
The rules of civil society don't change online. Now, obviously, you're handling more. Can you prosecute? We still would be
I'm especially trying to give some of the brands that they market.
With things like Google, you can actually create the claim to say that actually we aren't going to take the rights to that. The problem is now the end problem is though we're now getting into those sort of sovereignty issues of the different laws around what you can reuse and fair use in the US. There's no concept of fair use here. It's not limited. They may actually say, sorry, that's actually fair use. And you might work it out. This group is doing a charity or a political.
Yeah, I agree.